Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned in to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. Today, we at Real College Podcast are saying farewell to a longtime producer, Liv Riggins. Liv has been a regular contributor to the podcast for the past 3 years, longer than any other member of the team, and will thus be missed dearly for her knowledge and skill. I sat down with her recently to look back at some of her favorite stories and memories from her time here at RCP.
Like, when did you initially come into the podcast, and like, what was it that brought you to RCP?
Yeah, so I started, I interviewed in like April of 2017, so spring of my freshman year, and mainly that I'd been hanging around Radio K and DJing and kind of hoping to get a job, and this was one of the first ones that came up. I'm also majoring in English, you know, I like writing and stuff like that, and I figured that this would be a good kind of writing-adjacent job.
We'll start with Liv's very first podcast piece, a question of the week from years back.
Yeah, so I remember my first Vox Pop was really scary. I think just anything where you are walking around and trying to get people to talk to you on the street, you know, just random strangers, is going to be a little bit weird. I also tend to be, like, kind of on the quiet side, so it was really new to be out there with the recorder. I went out, it was, like, towards the end of spring, but I went out on a nice day and walked around campus and tried to get people to tell me, like, what the weirdest job they'd ever had was.
What's the weirdest thing you've ever learned at a job? My first ever summer job was as a 15-year-old. I worked as a tour guide for a dinosaur-themed amusement park.
How to cut off a cat's head without it bleeding too much.
I was working for my friend's dad, who does a lot of odd jobs. We were just cleaning out a horse stable, and he brought along a really big speaker and was just playing really loud heavy metal the entire time. And he like offered us all beer, and it was just kind of a strange but good vibe.
I was a lifeguard at a summer camp for a while, and we had a bunch of dead fish coming in for a really long time. Like, not like fully dead, like half dead. They're like cut in half. And I learned how to scoop them out of the water with absolute precision. Never missed one.
I worked as a CNA, so I got to wipe old lady asses.
One of my coworkers showed me how to get a plastic chair to sink to the bottom of the deep end of a pool.
So I worked at Quick Trip in the kitchen. The weird part was that, like, I'd work alone in the kitchen, and you're kind of separated off from the rest of the store, and it's just weird to think that there's just someone back there who, like, peeks out to go put the sandwiches there, but really doesn't have that much interaction with other people. And you start getting that weird feeling after being alone for 8 hours, like, especially stressed about time, making food and stuff. You just kind of, like, disassociate with the normal, like, interaction with people, because just all you think about is when the next food is coming up.
So I had a job working in a corn rootworm lab, and I discovered that there are a lot of types of spiders, like really big ones, that live in cornfields.
I gardened for a summer and I would like learn how to plant cool things. And I learned that there's like something called a pineapple weed, and it like smells like pineapple and it grows in the cracks of the sidewalk.
I'll never forget the time I had a temporary job working for AAA Daily Labor. And they said, okay, you're gonna go to National Lead. And the shift was from graveyard to about 7 o'clock, right? Okay, so here I am, I was, you know, in my early 20s, and I show up at National Lead, and I think it was like 12 o'clock. It was a brick building, all the windows were broken out. And so inside, this guy meets me, he's the foreman, right? And he's wearing he's wearing protective coverings over his shoes, his head. And I look around and I see 5 7-foot diameter thick brass vats that were used for boiling lead, okay, in the middle of winter. And that's why they had all the windows broken out, because obviously they had to keep the place cool. And so he looks at me and he says, you know, put this on, you know, and so I put on my protective covering, and I look in this guy's face, and he's as white as a sheet. So I thought to myself as a young man, this guy is suffering from lead poisoning. Anyway, I don't think I lasted about 2 hours, but I realized that at that point there are industrial processes with severe health consequences that go on every day in this country. And if you're going to get a job, there are hazards that you might want to pay attention to.
From questioning random individuals out on the street, Liv moved on to interviewing specific people of interest, such as her interview with the punk rock band Downtown Boys.
So Downtown Boys is like a, I feel like they're often called like a Chicanx punk band. I really like listening to Downtown Boys. I think their music's great. They do a great cover of Bruce Springsteen, Dancing in the Dark. And I heard they were coming to Minneapolis like 2 days before they came. I just emailed them like, and they were really like, hey, yeah, for sure. Come interview us. We're going to be at the Triple Rock. And I just showed up. They took me like back to their, to like the green room and then to their van. And I interviewed them in the van. And it was crazy to just realize that I could just email Downtown Boys and like 2 days later be in their van talking to them like about their music. And it's really cool. I guess I just remember how nice they all were to me. They were like really, just, you know, just really friendly.
I got the chance to talk with up-and-coming punk band Downtown Boys Friday night before their show at the Triple Rock. The opening band was still sound-checking, so we headed out to the van to talk about their recent album, the deeply intertwined nature of the personal and political, and some of the highlights of their tour so far.
You can come
Should I jump in the van?
I'm Victoria.
I'm Joey, too.
I'm Joey DeFrancesco.
Saxophone player Joe DeGeorge and bassist Mary Relegado joined us later in the interview.
To start off, you guys have gotten like a lot of coverage, a lot of attention recently. Has it been? Has it changed anything you do?
It really doesn't change that much the day-to-day of like our lives or the way that the band operates. There's just kind of like more work to be done in terms of like getting the record out there. I guess it does change how many people hear the record without ever coming to a show, which is kind of weird to know that more people are listening to the music and like they may never make it out to a gig, because for the longest time you found out about us from shows. But yeah, it hasn't really changed much like materially. There's like a lot more just like weird gossip that goes on, or like short-lived flames of like haterade, just like of the growing pangs of leaving like traditionally DIY scene. But in whatever scene we're in right now, we still are pretty DIY and punk, so yeah.
Yeah, great. So I guess another question for anyone would be, like, when did you start getting into music? And, like, when did you start getting into, like, activism and politics? And were those always together? Or, like, was there a certain point when they came together for you?
I think all of us in the band, like, it's really hard to be in Downtown Boys and not, you know, believe in some type of desire or hope for the way that the current world is ran, especially our country. So I think all of us, not to speak for everyone, but I think we all kind of have a natural intersection with like our art and our actions and our experiences and our like read of the world and of like the power dynamics that we're in right now. And then I think that, you know, we've all kind of participated in different ways in terms of from like being like community organizers to being activists to making other political music outside of Downtown Boys to, you know, being women, people of color in this world. So I think that's been pretty awesome just to know, like, in some ways, like, all of us have a piece of our existence that has been, like, very, you know, just being alive and existing is a political act if you're not coming from like the ruling class. But yeah, I think it's pretty natural to the band. Like this tour, people will email us and ask to table, or they'll message people in the band and ask, you know, like in Houston, that show was turned into a benefit. Or like people are also, I feel like, more forthcoming and asking to use the show space as a space for activism and politics. And that's been really great, because when we're going to cities and communities that we don't know, we don't just want to like parachute down a bunch of like politics or something. So it's really cool when the public or when fans want to use the space for that.
Yeah, it's really cool. You said it's been with this tour recently. Do you have any guesses as to why it's like, you know, now and not other times?
I think just because more people know about the band, and then at home in Providence, we've done a lot of like benefit shows and worked with like community organizations and organizers there. And then all of us are pretty like vocal about where our politics lie. And then finally, I think because we're just in a watershed moment where like people who are trying to get things done are going to use any means necessary.
What kind of music, what kind of media are you guys into or listening to in your free time right now?
I've been listening to some podcasts. We listened to that This American Life Afrofuturist podcast the other day that had the band Clipping in it. That was really good.
I like Princess Nokia and a lot of SZA, and I like a lot of old post-punk shit. You know, my free time, if there's like a record store close by, I try to go and like, enjoy it. It's like my happy place.
Frank Ocean.
Last question would be, what's your best or like your favorite show you've done recently? And like, why was it so good?
I mean, we had a great show in Washington, D.C. the other day. That was real good. We had a great crowd there. I think people came ready, and yeah, it was good.
All right.
And there was a show we played in McAllen, Texas, which is always our best. It's always like a great show, a great time. But it was the first time that we played there not as just our own show and not part of a festival. And so it felt much more like, you know, it didn't have the like energy or hype of a festival. And it's a really special city that's like on the border of Mexico and Texas. And there's just like a really, really big like Mexican-American population, and people really like work so much like for the space to exist. But it's just like the best feeling show. Like there's so much hope and desire, and it just sometimes like when you go to a city, it's like, oh, like what good am I here? Like what good is this show here? And there it just feels like you're such a part of the bigger context.
Yeah, I think like so many of the shows on this tour have been really amazing. One of my favorites was in New Orleans. We played with a band called Special Interest, who like were just so good. They were local to New Orleans, and Solange came to our show, and we all freaked out because we just couldn't believe she was there. We love her so much.
Yeah, that sounds good.
We're listening back to some of producer Liv Riggins' best pieces from her time at RCP. Next, her piece on immigration.
At the University of Minnesota Law School, he does different like outreach and immigration law clinics in outstate Minnesota. And I interviewed him as part of like a larger piece we were doing on immigration in Minnesota, and it was really interesting to sit down and talk to him and to hear about what they're doing, because I think, like, at least for me, I don't really think so much about like immigration and undocumented people living in like outstate Minnesota. But it is true, like there's a lot of people who are there who are undocumented and need all the same services that like people
in the Twin Cities tend to get more of, who are like new immigrants or undocumented or otherwise kind of, you know, need help with immigration law. And so it was really interesting to just learn about like a group that was like very much underserved. And he'd done some work in Northfield, which is where I'm from, and which also is somewhere that has like a, you know, surprisingly large Hispanic population, but often you don't like see them in the same places that like everyone else is. Mm-hmm. And there's issues like, you know, a lot of the Hispanic people in Northfield live in a trailer park that's like separated by the highway that doesn't have any way to get into town walking or biking or like by normal, you know, other normal modes of transportation. And so we talked about stuff like that. And it was just really cool to meet this guy, hear about a lot of the cool work that he was involved with at the law school. And, yeah, then be able to talk about, like, I'm not sure how much of it made it into the interview, but to be able to talk about somewhere that, like, I was from and that he also knew about.
Many people, or the majority of the people in the U.S., never ask themselves, what happens post-deportation, or what happens when a family disappears from my neighborhood? Where did they go? I mean, they are probably in Mexico or in their country of origin, but what's with their life?
Maggie had lived almost her whole life in Georgia when she realized she might need to leave.
In my case, I was trying to enter college, so I was trying to look up for grants and scholarships, or I was wanting to get a driver's license or get a part-time job like all my friends, and suddenly I realized that I'm not going to be able to get all that stuff and that things might get worse after 18. That meant that if I wanted to work, I would have to find other ways, that I wasn't going to be able to go into college. You realize that you don't have rights anymore.
Either choice of going to Mexico or staying in the U.S. carries a lot of uncertainty.
When they decide, they go through a period of what's going to be happening with my future. Will I be able to study, or will I be able to work in what I like? So those are many of the obstacles. And now and then, as we all know, because of Trump and everything, I mean, the racism, the hate, everything is on the air even more.
When you can't get the education you want, may not be able to get a job, are under the fear of arrest and deportation and facing racism, it can make sense to leave.
We're back to an unknown Mexico.
And there are challenges that come along with that.
For example, revalidating our U.S. studies took me 5 years. Many of the people have been struggling with that because it was being impossible, not only for people in like college level, but also little kids that were going back with their deported parents, and they didn't know that they needed all of these documents that they could only get in the U.S., and obviously they couldn't go back. Getting identity documents, or people just pointing out at you because of your accent or because you look like you belong there, but you don't. Once they talk to you, it's like, who are you? Like, not understanding even the jokes or how to move around. Everything was really new. And I mean, we have to be realistic. I mean, going back to a country that you don't know, and not because you want it, is very hard. I think it's important to also be realistic that Mexico is a beautiful country. I love it. I mean, I studied tourism and I love the country, but also be realistic that it's a country where there is a lot of impunity and a lot of corruption. And right now, the Mexican government has really not stood up to the situation in terms of creating a program that will reintegrate these families and these young people. So there were a lot of work around pushing and demanding the government.
It's begun to pay off, although Maggie notes that we should wait to see if the laws are actually implemented and how they're implemented before beginning to celebrate. Peña Nieto, the Mexican president, issued a declaration urging Congress to simplify the revalidation process. Within 3 months, a bill had been passed. Additionally, the GED is now being accepted in Mexico, a huge step up as deportees and returnees with the GED were previously counted as not having a high school education, which really limits job choices and possible education in the future. Still, it can be hard for returnees to get jobs with limited Spanish, a small social network, and little understanding of how things work in Mexico. Low-wage call centers, many of which are created as a result of NAFTA's free trade zones, benefit from increasing deportation. They get workers with a U.S. education, fluent English, and few other options, so they can pay them in pesos rather than dollars at rates around $100 for 40 hours of work. But for returnees, it's one of the only options available. Maggie and others in Otras Dreams in Acción have been trying to change that.
It has been the only door that has been opened for our community of deportees and returnees, right? Because they know English without an accent, because they know the culture. So, I mean, every time you call and complain or report a problem with your dish service or your phone or your AT&T or whatever, just have in mind that that person that's assisting you is probably a person that was deported and that grew up his whole life here and is on the other side of the border. So what we're really doing is creating opportunities besides the call centers. I mean, the call centers are like a good option to get back on your feet, but you shouldn't be stuck in there. You know, it could be another dead end and a limbo. So creating alternatives, I think, is one of the biggest part of all the, besides access to education, working with the universities in Mexico, and as I said, that mobility and eventually having a family reunification.
With deportation increasing and the DACA program expiring, it's getting increasingly difficult to have those family reunifications. For people in the U.S., Maggie says preparation and solidarity are the keys to getting ready for the chance of deportation.
It's important for people to also prepare and to have a plan in case that happens, but as well, I mean, mentally prepare, or as much as you can because you think you're prepared, but once you arrive, you realize that you're not. But at least knowing what organizations, where you can like get their kids the double nationality or get all those papers. And to try to be in touch with the community in terms of the dreamers here. I mean, or for example, if the mom stays here and they deport the son, you can be in contact with us and tell us, you know what, he's in Mexico City. We meet with him. I mean, just talking to him and him knowing that he's not alone or she's not alone makes a difference. And then we start growing and working from there. Try to see how we can fight together, how we can work together. Because at the end of the day, there are people on the other side of the border that could have been your friends or even your family now and then. The U.S. will always be part of us. It's our hometown. It's where we were formed and it's where we grew up. So we can't just say, okay, I'm going to Mexico and I'm forgetting about it because our families are here, because this is our place.
This is also what Deepinder Mayal, director of the James H. Binger Center for New Americans at the U of M's Law School, sees when he leads students in the Education and Outreach Program doing pro bono screenings for undocumented immigrants in rural Minnesota to see if they may have a potential claim for protection or legal status.
There are so many people who are American in all other ways except for this determination. It's like, what is the idea of being from a place? What is the idea of citizenship? You know, we have people who have grown up here, speak only English, have contributed to society, have paid taxes, have done everything it is to belong to a place that anyone else has done. And at what point does that person confer the right to call that place their home? It's a question that I think that is not just an American-Mexican question. This is a question that the world will be facing. Migration is up around the world. What are the rights of people who are moving around the planet? One of the most fundamental aspects about being a human is movement. Tens of thousands of years, humans have moved. And it's part of what allows, you know, us to change and grow and our cultures to form and to merge. So I think these are fundamental questions. Do we try to create a community where we reflect what is natural human tendencies as well as the movement of economic capital? Or do we try to block it all off?
We all aspire to have that mobility. The U.S. will always be part of us. I mean, our families are separated by the border. Obviously, if you're separated from your family, I don't think it'll ever be okay. But knowing that we're all going to fight together.
I'm Liv Riggins for Radio K's Real College Podcast.
That was one, I definitely remember the Caves episode, and just like the guy you interviewed for that.
Finally, piece of Liv's work that I remember the best, the Cave episode. How did that I love the conversation and background dripping sounds in this one.
So Caves episode, I interviewed Greg Brick, who is an expert in caves and like specifically Minnesota caves, which is just another, I think one thing all these have in common is just it's people that I never would expect to meet outside of like working for the podcast. Mm-hmm. And so I actually read part of his book. He sent me like a link to his book.
Yeah, I like how his last name is Brick.
Yeah, yeah, Greg Brick, a good name if you are into geology and caves. But I read some of his book and I prepared some questions. And yeah, we sat down and ended up having like a pretty long conversation just because he knew so much about Minnesota caves, Minnesota geology. I think the most memorable part for me is he talked extensively about like what it's like to go into the sewer tunnels of Minneapolis and getting covered in sewer waste, being really sick from it.
First time I went there, we found a break in the sewer wall in the right place. And I surmised looking at my maps that I had that this led to the cave.
That's Dr. Greg Brick, the author of books, magazine articles, and over 100 scholarly articles on caves, describing Sheik's Cave in downtown Minneapolis, one of the most horrific underground experiences in the Twin Cities. He's been exploring what's under the Twin Cities metro area to gain geological insights since 1988. And he has, including, most notably, the discovery of the warm water lens underneath downtown Minneapolis, which, as he told me in an email, adds deep roots to the long-held notion of the urban heat island. There'll be more on that later, but first, we're going back inside Sheik's Cave, where we find that learning about Minneapolis's underground might be dirtier than you expect.
And the raw sewage in there was about waist deep and flowing at 3 feet per second, and this is all the waste that comes from... you know, not to be too sordid, but I mean, all the toilets of Minneapolis are feeding into this system. So that's what you're walking through. There was an entire lake of raw sewage down there that we called the Black Sea for obvious purposes. You walk through it, I mean, it's this bubbling black sewage is just basically festering down there, located 75 feet below downtown Minneapolis, under the Gentleman's Club. And it's a natural cave, many rooms, it's kind of like a maze down there, and it was discovered in 1904. And at that time, what is now Sheik's was a bank. And so they became really worried that people were going to drill up through the cave walls and steal all the money in the bank. But it when you actually get down here, it's ridiculous because there's 30 feet of hard limestone. Probably another 30 feet of really solid glacial materials in there. So it'd be very difficult to drill through. But this cave is notorious because basically it's been incorporated into the sewer system. And one time it was full of cockroaches. I mean, I remember reading this report, the rivers of raw sewage that roar under the cave through tunnels, and the cockroaches just blacken the walls. I mean, they're just so thick. Now, other people would have been totally grossed out about this, but I was actually elated when I got down there because I'd been waiting years to get into this cave and actually see this remotest part of Minneapolis that you could possibly see. When I got back the next day, I was violently sick, and I came down with, I suppose it might be something like norovirus. And I merely walked through it, but there's so many droplets in the air from all this sewage coming down shafts, splashing at the bottom and so on. It creates all these aerosols that have bacteria in them. We were getting really sick. I mean, when I say sick, I mean you're just rolling on the floor for 6 hours of dry heaves. You know, there's nothing, after a while, nothing comes up, but you just keep heaving. And it's very disagreeable. But this cave, this sandstone maze that runs under like a square block under downtown Minneapolis, it was so rarely visited. It was visited once in the 1930s, and then again in the 1950s, and then the account that I spoke of with the roaches on the walls from the 1980s. So it had been, like, so far as I knew, decades since anyone had been in this cave. And it was very interesting because there were broken sewer lines in there, and there was like flowstone, which is just a mineral deposit from water.
Much like climbing a mountain or going on a backcountry trip, seeing remote sites like this requires some planning, and often more than one person to help with the effort.
Yeah, we had what we called Sherpas, like if you find like a buddy who is, willing to carry gear in there. But you do have to make a long list of supplies that you're going to carry because we had this Thailand cave incident recently where, the soccer players were trapped in there for days and days. And a similar thing could happen at Sheik's Cave because there is evidence that it floods to the ceiling. And so you had to think about that. And what if the water levels started coming up in the cave? And, you know, if you could find an air pocket, you might have to survive there for a while till the water went back down again. So this is a strange kind of thing to want to visit this cave, you know, once you read something like that. But I was just intrigued by the fact that, I mean, this is one of the most remote physical spaces in the city. I mean, it's like the Mount Everest, so to speak, you know, in the downtown area that I wanted to get to. And I had had years of experience caving, and so this is like the last thing I had left undone.
Any like skills or lessons, anything like that, that you'll think you'll be taking forward into the world?
Yeah, I feel like the big one that I'm just can think of right now is to just like ask things. Like, you'd be surprised how many times if you just ask people stuff, like how much they'll be like, yeah, sure, you know, whether it's like asking for an interview or doing Vox Pops or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's surprising the things you can get just by like asking when you're curious about it. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Liv, for all the time and hard work you've poured into RCP in your years here. We wish you the best. That's all for this week's episode. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Lizzie Ritchie, and Tosin Fasimo. I'm Nathan Fervoy, your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Follow us on Instagram at Real College Podcast for a look behind the scenes. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for working at the podcast for all these months and years. Any shouts out? Any final shout outs on the air?
I don't know. I would say the classic hi mom and dad, because I know my parents listen to this. I'm really a funny thing.